Get ready for Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by TruPrep. For all your prepping needs, visit TruPrep online at truprep.com or visit a TruPrep store in Roswell or Marietta. Listen in as Doug and Amy provide helpful tips on how to get ready for anything that comes your way. And now, your hosts, Doug and Amy.
Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. Today, we're going to be talking about electromagnetic pulses, their effect, the history, the whys, wherefores, and how to protect yourself from them. So get ready for a little bit of rough sledding today, as we've got a lot of science to talk, a lot of products, new questions that came in over the last week, and hopefully a very interesting show for you all.
Sounds exciting to me. I'm Amy. And we've got some great stuff to talk about today. And we are, of course, here on Ready Radio, where this is one of the topics that are of interest for our emergency preparedness listeners out there. And Doug, last week we aired our first show on Halloween, and we talked about emergency preparedness, sort of like an overview, and used zombies as a metaphor. How was your Halloween, by the way, Doug?
My Halloween was excellent. We got the kids out, did a little trick-or-treating. My son dressed up as a gator boy from the popular TV show over on Discovery Channel.
Ah.
My daughter was Doc McStuffins, and we hit the town and came up with a whole bunch.
Back up. It was who?
Doc McStuffins from the Disney Channel. She's a doctor who takes care of stuffed animals.
Oh, okay. Oh, how cute. Yeah. I bet she was precious.
No, they were fantastic and really enjoyed the day. And we saw a few zombies out there wandering the streets as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And got to have a great time. How was your Halloween?
It was good. You know, my favorite part is just jumping out and scaring the poor little kids to death. That's always my favorite part, so I got to do a little bit of that, and I think I OD'd on chocolate. I had a little bit too much. The hard part is when my favorite chocolate is on sale, and I can't pass it up.
What is your favorite chocolate, Amy?
I like Heath bars a lot and Reese's peanut butter cups.
So I would imagine you have a few of those saved up for the days when the grocery stores aren't open?
You know, I don't think it'll last that long, to be honest with you. Yeah. If it's in my house, it will be eaten. So that's not really one of my preps.
Okay. Well, when I was first getting started, I remember bringing up the idea of having some candy bars just as a morale booster. And someone said, well, you shouldn't do that. You should buy wheat. I was like, you know, I can stockpile wheat and candy bars. It's amazing that you can do more than one thing at a time and have a little bit of happiness along with your barrels of wheat and rice.
Yes, that's a good idea. You know, maybe I could get my husband to hide it from me, and then we'd still have some there. So then I'll have to look into that. And
there you go. Yeah. So we're going to be talking about EMPs this week. What brought up the EMP question in our minds? For me, there was a show that was on just recently called American Blackout, and they highlighted what would happen if the grid went down. And that sent me into a little bit of a research frenzy to find out what are likely causes for a total grid blackout. And on the top of the list are electromagnetic pulses. And electromagnetic pulses come from two different sources. You can have not only sources that are naturally occurring, but man-made sources. And from what I've been able to glean from the internet, it's not only large nuclear weapons that can create these, but there are now targeted electromagnetic weapons that are being developed that for the government to use to be able to take out various electronics in different campaigns in small theaters. So this is really a burgeoning area of scientific development, and we have a lot of information now available that wasn't available in the past.
Okay, well, that's awesome. Maybe what we can do today is look at each of those topics, kind of break them down a little bit. It is, I think, something, you know, since emergency preparedness has become a lot more mainstream, I think a lot of our listeners, or I would hope a lot of our listeners, are familiar with an EMP, meaning the electromagnetic pulse. Hopefully today we'll be able to clear up some of their questions and just kind of add some food for thought.
That's really the goal with all of our shows, is to be able to give people new information. Maybe they've heard about it before, but not in the level of detail that we're going to hope to go into. Get them able to look at the bigger picture. What are the myths? What are the realities? What you can do to be ready for whatever comes next.
Okay, that sounds great. Why don't we look at, Doug, just kind of what is an EMP, sort of an overview of that, and then maybe we'll look a little bit into kind of our two main categories there.
Electromagnetic pulse is basically a disturbance in the electromagnetic fields that are around electronic equipment. Fortunately, electromagnetic pulses don't have a direct impact on human tissue. It's not going to make your cat fall over irradiated, and it's not going to hurt you. But what it does is there's three stages to what is considered the pulse. The first stage is created by gamma rays, and that is mainly from a nuclear weapon. If you have a nuclear weapon go off, it creates gamma rays in the upper atmosphere, and the first wave goes through and is very difficult to prepare for because A, we don't know it's coming, but B, it affects most electronics. There are some electronics, particularly older electronics, which are more stable in an EMP phase one, but they're limited use and they're not really prevalent in our society. Every day that goes by, we become more dependent on electronics, which are more sensitive to the EMP one pulse. The second phase of an EMP pulse is more like a lightning strike. It's more of a limited duration, smaller area. The third phase is the one that really causes the most havoc. And the third phase is where what generates high voltage currents through antennas. Now, we think of antennas being the things that are on our cars or maybe a radio station antenna to broadcast, but really any length of wire can become an antenna. When I was younger, I had a stereo system I set up in my room, and I had attached a wire coil to the antenna lead and ran it all. Actually, it was a slinky.
Nice.
And I ran the slinky all the way around the room, and I finally had decent AM reception in my room because I had this gigantic antenna. Well, we are plugging ourselves into antennas and across the entire country every day. All of our electrical grid is set up as long cables that are sending power back and forth. And the EMP3 phase is going to affect that.
Okay, well, that's pretty interesting. And one of the questions that I've kind of wondered about also is how we kind of came to find out about the EMP.
Well, the EMP was speculated way back in the 30s, but our first real dealings with it came with the nuclear tests that came right at the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. As we were detonating nuclear devices, we noticed that we had some issues with the electronic recording equipment that was near the detonation site. It was first speculated that the EMP wave would be of a certain magnitude, and so there was a particular test that was set up to monitor the EM pulse. Unfortunately, all of the recording equipment was destroyed because the pulse was on several hundred orders of magnitude more than they expected. The recording equipment that was set up many hundreds of miles away were able to pick up some evidence of the pulse, but it wasn't really calibrated for that. So the U.S. decided to do a second test and to do it in, I wouldn't say near Earth orbit, but high altitude. And they used a weather balloon to launch a small, very small nuclear device a few hundred miles off the coast of Hawaii. And this was called the Operation Starfish project. Mm-hmm. And when that device went off, it fried. They were expecting it to be a localized event because most of their prior testing had been done on the ground. By putting it up in the atmosphere, the EM pulse was had a much greater range, and it was able to reach out a lot further than they anticipated. And most of Hawaii lost its power that day.
Wow. You said that was in the 1930s?
That was in the 1960s.
Oh, 1960s.
That was after the end of the World War II when we first noticed the effect. And this was the first real testing done to find out what the EM pulse was like. Now, remember, this is in the early 60s when we were still using transistor radios. And we're also talking about Hawaii. And that is extremely important because they did not have hundreds and hundreds of miles of basically antennas again. Transmitting power across, like, say, all the western states of the U.S. So their localized effects from it were very small because the third wave pulse relies on having long distance wires to be able to amplify the voltage. So since it went off near Hawaii, it did shut down Hawaii, but it was only shut down for, I believe, a grand total of a day and a half before transformers were repaired, replaced, and everything was back up and running. But that's not the way it would work today. We have much more dependence on very unshielded circuitry in critical systems. And we on the continental U.S. and most other areas have a lot more cable out there. And it's not just cable that you see strung up overground, but underground cables are susceptible too. And even things like water pipes that are made out of metal will pick up and amplify it.
Wow, that's it really does sound like out here in the Atlanta area, if something like that were to happen, then it just sounds like it would be something that's absolutely devastating. Do you think, and what I'm kind of curious also, Doug, is you said that they were up and running in a couple days. If that were to happen over Atlanta, would we have the similar results? Would it only take a couple days for us to be up and running?
Well, it depends entirely on the source phenomena. And if it's a nuclear source that has both E1 and E3 effects, then I think it's going to take a very long time. If it were simply a phenomenon that created only E3 effects, like a solar flare, or perhaps hackers taking down the grid, then I think we could be up and running much quicker, but in no means would it be a few days.
Yeah.
I know that we're coming up on a commercial break, so thank you all for tuning in to News Talk 1160, The Talk of the Town, and Ready Radio. We'll be right back.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Hey, welcome back. We're glad you're here listening today. We're talking about, well, a couple different things. One, we're talking about the electrical grid, and we've been focusing on an electric magnetic pulse. And I'm Amy, Doug is with me, and he is just giving us a plethora of information. And one of the things that we left off talking about what the EMP actually is, and something I'm very curious to learn a little bit more about, Doug, is how it occurs, what it comes from, and are there different sources?
Well, it's actually very fascinating the way an EMP is created. What it is there is a field around the Earth that is a magnetic field. And think of it as a half-filled water balloon. You know, so it's kind of squishy in your hands, it's kind of round, but you could push your fingers into it and distort it, and when you let it go, it would snap back to its original quasi-round shape. Well, when a large nuclear disturbance, and whether that's from solar radiation or from a nuclear device going off on Earth, impacts, it not only does it create heat and energy, but it distorts the magnetic field. And as the magnetic field is pushed out, that creates waves of one kind. And then, like a thunderclap, it snaps back in to where it was. And that creates a ripple effect. And that ripple effect does havoc on long lines or long pieces of metal. If it has the ability to run, it'll literally generate voltage along any long metal structure that it can find. Now, this isn't enough voltage to, you know, fry somebody who happened to be touching it, but it is enough to wreak havoc on sensitive electronics that are not expecting voltage to spike unexpectedly.
So would this happen with like maybe a sunburst, or are there other ways that this could possibly happen?
Coronal mass ejections or solar flares are one way that the Earth's magnetic sphere is impacted. Now, the Earth's magnetic sphere is impacted by solar mass ejections all the time. And back up when I lived in Alaska, we would see that as evidence as the aurora borealis. The northern lights are caused by particles flowing around the Earth's magnetosphere and then coming into the poles. Both poles are more susceptible to solar events than any other place on the Earth. But that does not mean that other places are completely safe. Back in the late 1850s, there was a solar event that hit and took out a large amount of radio equipment throughout Canada and the upper United States, because it was that large that it created that kind of ripple effect. If a solar flare of that magnitude hit the Earth today, it would probably cripple our grid.
And I imagine that we're using our devices and that sort of thing are a little bit more advanced than they were back then.
Not only are they more advanced, but they're more mission critical. I mean, back then, electricity and its applications were really a novelty item. Now, they are essential for survival. Everything that we do in a major city is dependent on electricity. And if that went down, and it has, I mean, when Hurricane Sandy went through New York, they were without power for several days. I mean, you can see the ripple effects that come out of that. But we are very dependent on our electricity, and every day that goes by, we become more dependent. So you have solar flares, but there's also man-made ways of disrupting the magnetosphere and creating electromagnetic pulse, usually by a high-altitude detonation of a nuclear device. Now, we normally think about mushroom clouds and nuclear devices being used against people on the ground, but in extremely high altitudes, you don't get the effects of radiation poisoning on the ground. Now, that does create artificial radiation belts around the Earth, and we know this because there have been several high-altitude tests. Both the Americans and the former Soviet Union did high-altitude tests in the mid to late 60s. In fact, one of the biggest high-altitude tests ever performed was performed by the Russians during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it was picked up by the American early warning system in Alaska, and it was reported that Soviet ICBMs were being launched, which caused even more panic given the current situation. So we have had these tests in the past, and we've seen the effects of these tests on not only the electronics of the time, but what their potential is.
So that would be something that would be somewhat like a terrorist attack then.
It could be. The technology needed to do a high-level burst is simply a nuclear device and a way to raise it high up off the ground. The original tests were done with hot air balloons. Well, not really hot air balloons, but balloons that lifted, like weather balloons, that lifted it very high into the stratosphere. So, I mean, that's a possibility, although we talk about nuclear detonations as a possibility, and I don't want to discount that possibility, but getting hit by a solar flare is an inevitability.
So it's inevitable.
Absolutely. It has happened before. It will happen again. The sun is continually projecting out radiation, and that's the reason that we have life on Earth, is because we're in the sweet spot to get solar radiation. But the sun is not even and dispersing the same amount of radiation all the time. There are these large coronal mass ejections that spray out large amounts of radiation that come toward the Earth. And our sun is not the only entity in the solar or the universe that is doing things like this. There are other things called quasars and pulsars that emit pure gamma rays. And gamma rays are what cause the E1 pulse and the electromagnetic pulse. When gamma rays hit the Earth, it causes, or hit our atmosphere, it causes free electrons to spin off from certain atoms, and that is what causes havoc with sensitive electronics. If we were hit with a targeted gamma ray burst, you could just pretty much count off every high-end electronic you've ever touched.
So the million-dollar question, Doug, is when is this going to happen?
Well, it happens every day. We're just not lined up for it. Think about how small, how tiny the Earth is in comparison with the sun. You can fit over 1 million Earths inside the sun and still have room left over. So as the sun is throwing off vapor here and left and right and up and down, we're only on a tiny little speck orbiting around a tiny little band of the sun. And we have to be not only in the same plane as the ejection, but at the same time. Now, an ejection like that will only take around 6 or 7 minutes, well, 8 minutes, to reach the Earth. So we don't have a lot of forewarning. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, and there's no way to prepare as we see it coming. We have to be prepared ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and that brings brings up a great question, too, is what do we do to prepare? And something to kind of look at is, and you alluded to earlier, sort of, you know, if the electricity goes out for a certain amount of time, maybe a couple weeks or something like that, I think all of us initially think of maybe the lights going out or we lose access to the refrigerator. But there are so many other things that actually rely on electricity that we don't really think about initially. And, you know, for example, like the grocery stores, and we have basically our grocery stores are full for, you know, what, a couple days, maybe?
About 3 days in an average city.
Right. What are some of the other things that you can think of off the top of your head that might be affected?
Water pumping stations. All the water pumping stations run off electricity. And while you may have gravity-fed water for a time in those large towers you see that says, you know, like the city's name on the side of the tower, those are pumped by electric pumping stations to get the water up there to provide the gravity force. So you may have an extra 2 or 3 days of water if you're near one of those substations, but it's only going to be a couple of days. The other thing that nobody thinks about is natural gas. Mm-hmm. Yes, natural gas is pressurized, but it's pressurized with electric pumps.
Ah.
A lot of other countries besides the U.S. use natural gas pumps in order to pressurize the natural gas. That way, if the electricity goes off, the gas still flows. We use electricity.
Oh, we as in Atlanta?
As in the United States.
As in the United States. Yeah, that's bad news, Doug.
Yes. Yeah. And remember me mentioning that in Hawaii, because it was a smaller area with smaller electrical lines, that it was a more limited effect from the E3 pulse. There are ways that we could cheaply and effectively cut down our lines by creating breaker stations that would stop the electromagnetic pulse's effect on the long lines. I read one estimate that it would take about $1 billion to be able to retrofit the entire U.S. grid to be EMP secure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that sounds like an incredible sum of money, but when you think about that we are $16 trillion in debt right now and spending money in vast quantities, we spend more than $1 billion on relatively simple projects like education and infrastructure. This is a project that could potentially save 200 million lives for $1 billion.
Wow. Yeah. Sounds pretty darn important to me. And I mean, it sounds like this is not just a matter of if, but a matter of when. And there are a lot of people out there that really believe that. But I just wanted to thank our listeners for listening in, and we're going to take a quick break. And we will be back in just a moment.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back. I'm so glad you're with us. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town. And we are talking about electric magnetic pulse. And something, as we get into the different things that we need to prepare, items that we could actually prepare for. One of the things, Doug, I wanted to tell you about was a news article that I came across recently, and it was in the New York Times. And the article was called, "As Worries Over the Power Grid Rise, a Drill Will Simulate a Knockout Blow." And this drill is called GridX 2. And this is something that's happening like next week. This is happening November the 13th and the 14th. And basically, and I would love for our listeners, if it's something that they're interested to know what our government is doing about this, to do a little research, you know, get out on the web and see what they can find out. But basically, there are like 150 different companies that are working with the government to do like a grid shutdown simulation.
Now, to be clear, they're not actually shutting the grid down. They're just role playing what would happen.
Right. Yeah. It was, you know, kind of after reading this news article, just kind of digging around, it's pretty tough to get some good solid information. But yes, I sure hope they don't shut it down for real.
Yeah. You know, it's easy to say it's just a test, but then again, so was Chernobyl.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, Doug, let's talk a little bit about, you've given us some excellent food for thought. And one of the things I am sure that, I hope we're not scaring our listeners to death, but one of the things I really think that we need to talk about are some things that our listeners really can do to prepare themselves for the inevitable.
Our goal is never to scare people. It's just to educate them and give them the hope that there is something that you can do to be ready for what's coming next. And in this situation, there are two basic fields that we need to talk about. First is, what if it's a solar flare? And the second is, what if it's man-made?
So we're actually going to prepare differently for each one?
One, the solar flare requires less preparation to be ready for than the man-made. The solar flare is not going to create the E1 pulse. It's only going to be an E3 pulse. And what that means is that as long as your electronic equipment is not connected to an antenna that it can amplify the pulse by, it's going to be okay. So you're not going to have to create large systems to protect it from radiation. What you're going to be basically doing is unplugging things. If you unplug things, now the grid's going to be fried. That's a given, because okay. The pulse is going to run down all of those wires above ground and underground, hit all of the transformers, and blow them out. There are 20 large transformers based around the U.S. that do major shifts of power between substations and power generation points. These transformers are not something that we keep in stock. They are not easily built, and they are not repairable. Mm-hmm. We have, according to my research, we have between 2 and 3 of them as back holding stock if something were to happen. We need 20.
Where do we get them?
We get them from overseas, of course.
Oh, okay.
So if there was a problem, and remember, the electrical problem, if it was solar-based, is not going to be localized. It was going to be planetary. They're going to need these transformers, too, the countries that are producing them. So we're going to go down the list.
I see. That doesn't sound...
That doesn't sound good. But the silver lining to a solar flare is that you are able to simply unplug your equipment. Small equipment is not going to be able to amplify the pulse like long lines will. And so most of your electronics will probably be okay.
Will we have a heads up, though, Doug? If something like that were to happen, will we have a heads up so that we can go ahead and unplug things?
No.
Oh.
Not at all.
Okay.
So if you really want to be careful, the best idea is to keep either have a secondary, which is unplugged at all times, or to unplug things when they're not being used. And that's going to greatly increase your chances of not having it plugged in at the moment the flare hits.
Yeah, that'd be a kind of a tough habit for me to get into. I'm just not used to unplugging things that
not
using.
Think about electronics like laptops. Laptops are fantastic, much better than desktops because they use much less power. That means that you're going to be able to charge it and run it off of a solar generator or a diesel generator or some other kind of electrical generation equipment much, much more efficiently and cheaply. So if you have a laptop instead of a desktop, you unplug the laptop every time you're done using it. That laptop will be safe from the solar flare. Same thing with your cell phones. By having a battery-operated radio, it's not going to have enough antenna to be able to amplify the signal, the radio will be fine. Now, the radio station may not have power, but things like shortwave radios, especially shortwaves that can pick up signals from other countries or other areas, fantastic equipment to have with very little preparation you're going to have to do in order for it to still be usable. But the real kicker is people who have the ability to generate power. Your automobile is the best generator that everybody owns. That's not going to be affected by a solar flare. If you have electrical generation equipment, either solar or hydro or wind or even fossil fuel-based, that's still going to work. So you're going to be able to power all of these devices. That's going to decrease the recovery time. Now, granted, hospitals have generators, but they only have 3 days' worth of fuel. And the ability to move fuel from refineries to cross-country is going to be limited. So you're going to have to start rationing your electrical generation requirements. But the beauty is that all these devices are still going to work. Now, that is not true for a man-made EMP.
Okay, so far, it sounds like I need to just unplug stuff and maybe just have a backup. Now, one of the things I think, Doug, that I'd be very interested in. Now, I did read One Second After. It's a fiction novel. And basically, in this novel, it was an excellent read, by the way. It was very thought-provoking, and it really brought up some things I didn't think about initially. But I think I personally would be a little bit more interested in preparing for something along those lines. For example, in the book, vehicles stopped moving. Everything was down. And, plugged or unplugged, it was dead, so...
And that's more typically seen with a man-made EMP, mm-hmm. because the man-made EMP is going to have the E1 signal created by gamma rays, which is going to fry sensitive circuitry.
So how do we prepare for that scenario?
Skin effect. Skin effect is a technical term, which is basically by creating a conduit for the radiation to flow around, it will protect what's inside of it. Now, the easiest way to shield, and we can't guarantee shielding, let's put it this way. Shielding is just like winter coats, okay? It's not an all or nothing principle. Now, let's say that, you know, it's 40 below outside and all you have got is a light winter coat.
Okay.
Do you say, well, shoot, this coat isn't going to protect me at 40 below, so I'm going to just go out in my t-shirt because, you know, it's not going to do it anyway.
I see your point.
Right. Some shielding is better than none, mm-hmm. but it may not be everything you need it to be. The question is how sensitive are you and how cold is it?
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I do pretty well when it's chilly outside. Everyone else is bundled up and I'm not, because I'm not as sensitive. I'm like an old cathode ray tube television out there putting out heat and I'm fine. But you get someone who is, you know, thin, light, and all modern, and they're exposed to that same amount of radiation, mm-hmm. they're not going to make it as well.
Gotcha.
So you can kind of tailor your amount of shielding to the devices that you're using. Yes, it would be absolutely ideal to build full-blown Faraday cages to military-grade specifications for every electronic piece that you wanted to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had an unlimited budget, I would encourage you to do so. But for the rest of us, we do triage. We take some items that we think are extremely important, maybe solar cells, and try to create the most perfect Faraday cage we can for them. For other items that are less sensitive, maybe you can just create a insulated container. And the best way to create an insulated container for an EMP pulse would be to first create a skin effect shell around the item using a very thin metallic sheet. And the easiest one to come by is tin foil. Now, mm-hmm. aluminum foil is not really thick enough to create the shield we really want. So what we're going to do is we're going to wrap it several times with aluminum foil and make sure that it's completely encased on all sides. Then place it in a non-reactive material like cardboard. And after that, place it into a thicker metal container that is contiguous. So it does not have any openings and it creates a shield all the way around. The best form that I've seen for this are galvanized metal trash cans. A galvanized metal trash can with a secure fitting lid, not dented up, not with lots of dings and holes and everything else, but a normal regular shaped one with a secure fitting lid will create a fairly decent barrier for the E1 pulse.
So then the trash can itself would essentially be the Faraday cage.
In effect, it creates a similar proposition. Now, it is no way, I hate to call it a Faraday cage because it is not as good as a real mm-hmm. Faraday cage. It's kind of like when you say, well, I have a car, my neighbor has a car. I've got a Yugo, he's got a Ferrari, but we've all got cars. Yeah, you mm-hmm. both got a car, but they're completely different animals. And a real Faraday cage is a much different animal than my cobbled together contraption of tinfoil, cardboard, and a garbage can. But my tinfoil garbage can and cardboard box is only going to cost me about $30. And if I put a couple of things in there that I would like to have, like two-way radios, mm-hmm. some extra batteries, a few items that I think are necessary but are no way mission critical. The other thing is, it's really easy to get into it. I can open it up and use the things and throw them back in later. I know that we're coming up close on a commercial break, and I really would like to thank everyone for listening and for visiting TruePrep.com, our wonderful sponsors. There are friends that are keeping us on the air. Everybody here at News Talk 1160, the talk of the town, is fantastic, and we thank you all for giving us your lunch hour to learn a little more about preparedness and being ready. We'll be right back.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. We're discussing EMPs today, and the, not only the causes, but the effects. And that's one of the more interesting questions that's coming up is, you know, how long should we be getting ready for? And that really depends, again, on the type of EMP it is. Now, if it's a solar flare and the only thing that's been wiped out is the power grid, then you're going to see localized electronic applications popping up with generation. If it's a man-made one, then it's going to be more localized. It may only be our country. The rest of the world may not have any impact at all. But the flip side is it's going to be everything down to the smallest electronics that we have, anything that's not in a decent Faraday cage or that metal box. So, Amy, let me ask you. Let's start with the solar flare. If the solar flare happens, and it's going to happen sooner or later, and we have not put in any implementation of any plan to keep it from frying out all those 20 critical transformers, we're going to be looking at a minimum of 4 years without power and a maximum of somewhere between 10 to 15. How are you going to get ready for 15 years, Amy?
That, what a trick question. I think I'm going to turn Amish. And at least learn from them, because let me tell you, they've got it right. If the Amish, you know, I really do look up to them in the way that they, their lifestyle, the way that they live, because if something like this were to happen, I don't think they'd even notice.
That's very true. You know, the advantages of, and I hate to use the word advantage for a solar flare event like this, but you would still be able to generate power. I mean, it's not that every single little tiny electronic thing is fried beyond repair. So are there some ways that you would recommend for power generation for an average person?
Well, I think, yes, there's a couple different things that we have. I mean, well, and the thing is, too, you said power generation. If we're looking at power generators, that is, you know, something absolutely that would come in handy. The problem is, Doug, what I can see is that if something like that were to happen, there are only so many of those on the shelves. So if it were to happen, you know, it's going to be madness, and there's not a chance that, there's not a good chance that you're going to come out of the store with one. So it might be a darn good idea to look into something like that now before it actually happens.
Now, the downside to local power generation is that it is very expensive. Is that correct?
From what I gather, yes, it is.
Now, we have been offered a wonderful product to spotlight this week from our friends at True Prep. It's called the JASPAK, and they're on the web at JASPAK.com. They make a fantastic product right here in Georgia. It's manufactured in Canton, and what it is basically is it's called a solar generator. Now, it's not really a generator. It's a battery pack. Mm-hmm. But it's a battery pack that has a good controller that hooks up to a solar panel. And the solar panel is able to charge the battery while the battery runs things as well. Some of the solar panels that they are sold with produce enough energy so that they can charge the battery while running a refrigerator, for example. It also has a pure sine wave inverter, and the advantage to that is the sine wave is the way the electricity is coming out to the applications that are using it. A modified sine wave kind of has like this on and off pattern. If you looked at it on a graph, it would look kind of like blocks, up and down blocks, whereas a pure sine wave is flowing and smooth, and your iPod, your laptop, your, you know, new space station that you're building in your backyard are critically dependent on pure sine waves coming into and flowing into to the equipment. And you can really fry out something with a modified sine wave if it's not able to handle that. However, some applications like power tools and you know, real brute force kind of electrical applications don't really care. But these products have pure sine waves so that you can charge anything that you own with it. They start at $4,700. Which is a significant investment, but they are also eligible for a tax rebate up until 2016. And there's a 30% tax rebate for any solar application that you use on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So if you were to use this pack on a daily basis, work it into your life, then it would be eligible to get that 30% rebate, which really is a significant decrease in the cost of the item.
Oh, that's awesome. Let me ask you this. One of the things that I, one of the questions that I kind of came up with is this something you would actually be able to use indoors? Because when I think of generator, I think of a gas generator. You have to put it outside. It's very loud. People know that you have it. And I've even heard of generators being stolen by, I've heard this, that someone takes a lawnmower, and they put it outside, they crank it up, and, you know, if you're sleeping at night, and then they take your generator, and you still hear that humming of the lawnmower outside, and your generator is gone.
The other weekend, when I went to the Canton Zombie Fest, I walked by the True Prep booth, and lo and behold, the owners had set up a diesel or gas generator behind it in order to power the booth when it got dark, mm-hmm. and you could hardly talk over the thing. I mean, they are loud. They are, it's just like running a gas engine inside your home. Now, this is not an actual generator. It's a battery. Mm-hmm. It's a battery just like you have in your laptop or in your car. It's not emitting anything. It's not actually producing energy. It's just storing the energy that you created using a solar panel. So yeah, you can put that inside the house. The batteries are maintenance free. They have a venting mechanism in case, so there's no overpressure, but they're not producing any emissions on their own.
Okay, well, that sounds like it, with that 30%, you know, credit, then that sounds like a pretty good deal.
Yeah, and like I said, the company is JASPAK, J-A-S-P-A-K, and they're available online. It's available from TruePrep.com, and it is our TruePrep product of the week.
Dun-dun-dun! All right, well, just to kind of close out things, Doug, I think maybe a few of the other things that we could sort of talk about just to kind of close things up. We talked about, of course, power as being something to prepare with, and we talked about different periods of time. And if we're looking at such a long period of time, what are some of the other things, Doug, that we would need maybe to stock up on and to use to prepare for?
Well, Amy, in a lot of ways, this is no different than any other disaster or emergency preparedness situation. You're still back to the initial things we talked about on our first show, which is something that you can listen to on readyradio.net at any time. If you've missed part of this show, or if you want to rehash what we said last week, readyradio.net has all of our shows archived, and it has a place that you can submit questions. And that was what led us to our product of the week this week, was JC asked us what was a good source of portable power generation. So we talked to our friends at True Prep, and this is the answer they came up with for us.
That's right, JC, and thank you so much for that question. And when we do get these questions, it's something that we look at seriously, and we do a little research, and we get back with our listeners the following week. So we really do encourage you all, if you have a question about something that you have heard, to go ahead and put those questions out there. We are looking at them, and we're very excited to see what your questions are.
But to answer your question, what you need to prepare for other than the Faraday cages and the trash cans are your basic things we talked about on our first show, which are food, water, shelter, and a way to defend it. Once you have those basic human needs provided for, then you can start to branch out and worry about more of the luxury items. But this is something that is going to be a long-term effect. It may not be where you are completely without power. You still can possibly run a microwave or run a wheat grinder or run something else electrical if you have a solar generation, wind or hydro, but you're going to be taking a life at a very different pace than we have been looking at it for the last 50 years. And as we move into that, having a stockpile of food, having a way to purify water, all of the things we discussed in our first show, which you can listen to at readyradio.net, will bring into play.
Great. And I know that our sponsor, True Prep, is an emergency preparedness retail store, and they it's an excellent place you can actually walk into and see and touch and feel and ask, because I know all the people that work there are very knowledgeable and can help you get on your way.
I know we're running out of time, Amy, but did we have one more question that was sent to us through the internet?
We did, and that was sent to us from last week. And the question came from Robert Indicator. He asked, what is your opinion on the 0.02 micro Sawyer all-in-one system? It seems perfect for backpacking and bucket drip filtration for a home in emergency situation. Thanks, Robert. Well, Robert, I did a little research, and first, let me tell you that I do not own one of these. It is quite interesting I don't own one because I own a Berkey, the Berkey system. But what I did find was it did have mixed reviews. One of the things I was interested in this particular filtration system was that it does remove viruses. So that's one of the big things, Robert, that I look for whenever I'm looking for water filtration or purification, is that if it removes viruses, then it's removing basically everything else, your bacteria and heavy metals and that sort of thing. So it does say that you could get possibly 100 million gallons, which I was quite amazed at, but I also read a little bit more into it, and it said to maximize the effectiveness and the longevity of your filter, that you need to it recommends back flushing the filter after every use. So if that's something that you are willing to do, then I think, you know, it would possibly be a good one to look into.
So this is a ceramic filter, is that it's probably a type of filter that uses small pores to filter out what's coming through. That's where you're getting the 0.2 micron, and that's why you're having to back flush it. Unlike activated carbon filters or filters that are mixed between ceramic and carbon, this is relying solely on the size of the aperture mm-hmm. in order to do its filtration. The back flushing will then help that, but it's not going to be able to deal as effectively with some of the other contaminants like radioactive materials that a different filter would do. Folks, we are just about out of time. Check us out on readyradio.net where you can listen to old broadcasts or catch up on new events that are coming up. Please tune in to us every Thursday at noon here on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town, and do check out our sponsors at True Prep. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by True Prep. For all your prepping needs, visit True Prep online at truprep.com or visit a True Prep store in Roswell or Marietta. Tune in each week as Doug and Amy get you ready for anything that comes your way. Ready Radio, Thursdays at noon, only on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.